population of 60 million readers. Support for the ERA was written into both the Democrat and Republican Party platforms. On the other side was Phyllis Schlafly, but as George Gilder has remarked, that was enough. She was composed, brilliant, and relentless. Refusing to be intimidated by conventional thinking, Schlafly repeatedly raised questions that polite people thought it bad taste to mention. Thus, for example, she questioned how ERA would affect the draft, family law, abortion, gays, adoption, widows' benefits, even locker rooms. Though the amendment's proponents sneered at Schlafly's claim that the ERA would end the draft exemption for women, law professors would soon be making the same point in the likes of the Yale Law Journal. Schlafly could have rested on her laurels after writing A Choice Not an Echo. She could have rested on her laurels after defeating the ERA. She could have rested after being named, as her biography cheerfully notes, 1992 Illinois Mother of the Year. Indeed, Schlafly could have rested on her laurels on any number of occasions over the past half century, but she kept going. There is no important political debate for nearly half a century in which Schlafly's influence has not been felt. Schlafly's feminist counterpart and molecular opposite is Gloria Steinem. While Schlafly is a serious intellectual, Steinem is a deeply ridiculous figure who succeeded as a journalist only by becoming the news rather than reporting it. That leftists treat them in exactly the wrong way suggests that they are totally blinded to the facts by their ideology. Steinem's influence was limited to a narrow sliver of liberal women living in big cities. It just happened to be the sliver that controls the news and pop culture. Thus, for 3 decades, Gloria Steinem could not get her toenails painted without a major feature spread in a glossy magazine covering the event in laborious and hyperbolic detail. But apart from the ephemeral achievement of winning the hearts and minds of liberal women who pen endless articles praising Steinem, it's hard to get a handle on any concrete accomplishments. Her biggest cause, the Equal Rights Amendment, failed when it was rejected by American women who lined up behind Phyllis Schlafly. A string of follow-up half-measures, such as the Economic Equity Act, failed. Her magazine failed. Her winsome anti-male campaign, captured by her slogan, "A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle," failed. The feminist movement failed. While Schlafly was writing about military policy, getting presidential candidates nominated, drafting Republican platforms, and raising 6 children, Steinem was writing a book about self-esteem, Revolution from Within, a book of self-esteem. Steinem never had children and now goes around prattling about how unhappy her life has been. As she told ABC's Primetime Live, a program that would never interview Schlafly, "I was unmothered or unparented. I was neglected." Meanwhile, Schlafly is a senior statesman in the Republican Party. She has had a dominant influence on the Republican Party platform for at least 2 decades. Ask any United States senator, Republican or Democrat, would you rather have your pet bill opposed by Gloria Steinem or by Phyllis Schlafly? Yet in the mainstream media, the hero is the unaccomplished feminist harpy. Steinem is in. The elites cannot cite her bravery often enough as she endures endless hardships on the cocktail party circuit from Aspen to Beverly Hills. In the special 1986 issue of Time Magazine's Almanac of Victories, Disasters, Heroes, and Hurrahs for the years 1936 to 1986, Gloria Steinem was the hero of 1971, along with such individuals as Winston Churchill, hero, 1941, Allied Supreme Commander Dwight D. Eisenhower, hero, 1944, and Mother Teresa, hero, 1979. In a 1999 ABC News special report titled A Celebration, 100 Years of Great Women, Barbara Walters fawned over Steinem and her fellow termagants for changing the world. Feminist, this may be one of the most misunderstood words of this century, but without them, we would be living today in a very different world. Schlafly was mentioned only as an obstructionist sidebar to these courageous women. Evidently, the way feminists created a very different world related to how in 1960, as Walters explained, Father Knew Best TV told us that true fulfillment was a clean house. But today, TV tells us that true fulfillment is abortion, lesbianism, and prostitution. You've come a long way, baby. Indeed, the entertainment industry is one of the few ballywicks where feminism is still taken seriously. In the wonderful new world created by feminists, an actress's surest route to an Academy Award nomination is to play a prostitute. Among the actresses to have been nominated for Oscars for the devilishly challenging task of portraying a prostitute are Julia Roberts, Pretty Woman, Kim Basinger, L.A. Confidential, Jane Fonda, Clute, Jodie Foster, Taxi Driver, Elizabeth Shue in Leaving Las Vegas, Sharon Stone, Casino, and Mira Sorvino, Mighty Aphrodite. Though feminism hasn't made much of a dent in America, it has taken the worlds of news and entertainment by storm. Female celebrities are no longer in the mold of Sophia Loren, Grace Kelly, Lauren Bacall, Carol Lombard, or Audrey Hepburn. In the bright new feminized Hollywood, the female divas are Britney Spears, Madonna, Pamela Anderson, Elizabeth Hurley, Sarah Jessica Parker, and Jenny McCarthy. Whatever feminism is alleged to have accomplished, it did not create a world in which women are admired for something other than playing or being sluts. Time magazine sarcastically portrayed women attending a Phyllis Schlafly luncheon at the 1984 Republican National Convention for imagining that they were mainstream. A Texas delegate said, quote, "It amazes me that people would think this is not a cross-section of the American public." To demonstrate what a preposterous conceit this was, Time magazine noted that the woman had waved an encompassing arm at the room full of overwhelmingly white, conservative, married women, whose greatest mark of diversity was whether they wore silk or synthetic. As regular readers of the elite media know, mainstream means homosexual drug addicts living in Manhattan. The party favor at the Schlafly luncheon was General Daniel Graham's book on the Star Wars defense system, We Must Defend America. At the Democratic National Convention event attended by Steinem, the party favors were condoms. It is an absolute moral certainty that no conservative, certainly not an influential one like Schlafly, will ever be acknowledged by magazine glossies busily passing out Woman of the Year awards to mediocre left-wing harpies. In 1992, Glamour magazine made Hillary Clinton its Woman of the Year for, quote, "never apologizing for who she is," as if it were an incredibly brave act to be a liberal in America today. Anita Hill had been Glamour magazine's Woman of the Year the previous year, but she was given a special mention in Hillary's edition because, the magazine raved, Hill's influence had only multiplied over time, inspiring others to take chances, to stand up and win. It turned out that one of the women who was inspired to stand up and win was Paula Jones. Strangely, though, Jones was never honored as a Glamour magazine Woman of the Year. Other brave feminists honored by Glamour in 1992 included Carol Moseley Braun, Lieutenant Paula Coughlin, who brought sexual harassment charges against the Navy, Katie Couric, quote, "for boosting ratings and feminism at the same time, as we have come to expect from television personalities," feminist author Susan Faludi, and Whoopi Goldberg. Does it ever occur to anyone at Glamour that their Woman of the Year lists never include anyone who might possibly have voted for Ronald Reagan, ever? Reagan was quite popular with Americans, even if he was not with the editors of Glamour magazine. This is what it means to be part of the cool crowd in America. Liberal snobbery is no more rational or factually based than the in crowd in junior high school. The in crowd even posts lists in mainstream magazines announcing who is in and who is out. Steinem is always in, and Schlafly is always out. Indeed, conservatives are always out. Yesterday's news, fighting irrelevance, fading from the limelight. This is odd, since if any conservatives were ever in, they neglected to tell us. Matt Drudge has been out 3 times in Vanity Fair, but he's never been in. Rush Limbaugh, along with Schlafly, was said to be taking a back seat in 1993. He was on the outs. 1993 is not the time to be far-right in America. The Washington Post pegged Limbaugh as out in 1996, giddily quoting a Rush Room proprietor who averred that Limbaugh is fading right now in popularity. The Phi Delta Kappan magazine gave Limbaugh a snooty, least credible article prize for a 1995 column in Family Circle. In 1997, the Bergen County Record noticed that Rush Limbaugh's conservative star may be fading. When it became clear that no amount of sneering would turn Rush into Jim Jeffords, the media ignored him. Except Lewis Lapham, editor of Harper's Magazine, who was absolutely obsessed with Limbaugh, mentioning him in snotty asides in 17 Harper's editorials since March 93. It's not clear if it's ever possible for liberals to be out, and if they are, what it means. But if you are a conservative and the mainstream media says you're out, buy beachfront property now. You know you're in when they say you're out. The corollary is, you can always tell a rotten organization by the New York Times predilection to call it much admired or highly respected. This is how reporters convert their purely subjective feelings into hard news. When ABC was considering scrapping Ted Koppel's Nightline in early 2002, because of its low ratings, the most common reaction was, "Is that still on?" At the Times, they were inconsolable. In a series of lengthy elegies, the program was factually described as, quote, quality news and, quote, an admired news program. Admired by whom precisely? Rush Limbaugh wasn't losing any of his audience, but the Times never calls his program admired. Truly pompous liberals have achieved such a refined level of snobbery, sometimes you wonder if they realize people are listening. During the 2000 presidential campaign, the press was in a high dudgeon about Bush having traveled abroad only 3 times, in addition to his many trips to Mexico. But beyond those trips, as the New York Times put it, Bush had traveled only to China, Gambia, Italy, Egypt, and Israel. How many Americans consider that laughable? It is hardly surprising that liberals are terrified of campaign finance laws that allow ordinary people to participate in public political debate by contributing to political campaigns. Relaxed campaign finance laws are dangerous because they allow hoi polloi to get their 2 cents in. Noticeably, the news organizations frantically hawking the money in politics stories continuously neglect to mention that the media is wholly exempt from the campaign finance laws they adore. There's no time to mention the media exemption when there are important stories to be run on courageous politicians like Senator John McCain, who championed the media's utterly self-interested demand for campaign finance restrictions. Carrying water for the media is known as fighting powerful interests. Powerful interests that are not quite powerful enough to prevent the entire media from erupting in joy at the mere mention of McCain's name. The sinister powerful interests McCain confronted were little old ladies sending $20 checks to the Christian Coalition. Even if the little old lady is Imelda Marcos, in politics, power is information, and no special interest group in the history of the universe has wielded the power of the modern media in America. Despite all the hysterical news accounts of money corrupting politics, what liberals really believe is that the power to influence elections by persuading voters should reside exclusively with the media. Thus, complaining of the campaign fundraising by Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton in early 2000, Neil Rosenstein of the New York Public Interest Research Group told the Washington Post, "Hillary and Rudy are already in the paper every day. The media, evidently, should be the sole purveyors of information about political campaigns." In the left's doomsday scenario, the campaign finance laws would permit political speech by people who worry about taxes and crime, don't have $200 million or a position with the elite media, or, God help us, have traveled overseas only 3 times. Liberals malign such people as the rich. Only the mind-boggling resources of the left could persuade so many people that these elitist snobs speak for the little guy. Excerpt from a deposition of a staffer in Senator Bob Packwood's office, 1975 to 1976. "I entered his office. Senator Packwood was alone, and he immediately closed the door and did not say anything to me, but grabbed me and had me pinned backwards with my back to the wall. And before I could say anything, I was very shocked. He stuck his tongue in my mouth and was French kissing me without ever asking me or saying anything, without any warning. He grabbed and embraced me and kissed me against my will, and I could not remove him from me for quite a while." Senator Bob Packwood had been madly chasing, groping, and slobber-kissing female staff and lobbyists since at least 1969. By his own heavy-breathing account, there were, quote, 22 staff members I've made love to, and probably 75 others I've had a passionate relationship with. All this was well known to Packwood's feminist supporters for decades, but he was never exposed. Packwood was, quote, good on women's issues, which consisted primarily of his enthusiasm for killing off anything that might result from one of his successful sexual conquests. But things changed dramatically when feminists didn't need him anymore. Back when the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League wanted Packwood's pro-abortion vote, the establishment media could not produce enough luminous adjectives about the man. Invoking the blabocracy's favorite words for utterly typecast tax-and-spend liberals, Packwood was called a maverick or a gadfly. He had courage, political savvy. There are literally hundreds of news items using these words in connection with Bob Packwood. The media were in a swoon. Packwood could have been the Boston Strangler for all the adversary press cared, as long as he supported a woman's right to choose and periodically denounced Ronald Reagan. Packwood was protected, and not merely protected. Packwood was hailed in hallucinatory press notices ceaselessly citing his so-called courage. The fairy tale affair between Packwood and the media, however, came to a tragic end the second feminists didn't need him anymore. In January 1993, feminists got themselves a president who was at least as committed to abortion as Packwood, and for pretty much the same predatory reasons. There was no possibility that President Bill Clinton would appoint a Supreme Court justice who would vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. There was no possibility that he would sign into law even the most innocuous restriction on abortion. In fact, abortion may be the only issue on which Clinton did not flip, repeatedly vetoing a series of partial birth abortion bans passed by large majorities in both the House and Senate. Ironically, the very Republican administrations that Packwood had taken such glee in maligning for 12 years had indirectly been his salvation. Only after the 1992 election that put abortion's truest friend in the White House and returned Packwood to the Senate with the vigorous support of the National Abortion Rights Action League would Packwood's half-century of lechery finally see the light of day. Florence Graves, the reporter who exposed the blow-dried predator, first learned of Packwood's serially lewd behavior in April 1992. As Graves remarked, it was, of course, very likely that loads of Washington journalists had known about Packwood for years. Despite her interest in pursuing the matter, several news organizations informed Graves that they were not interested in financing the story. She was able to scare up no institutional support. A deal with Vanity Fair fell through. Consider that this was in 1992, after Anita Hill had saved America by raising the critical issue of sexual harassment. Though Packwood had been molesting dozens upon dozens of female staffers and lobbyists for decades, they evidently weren't much interested in pursuing the matter either. Luckily, he tended to be surrounded by women who shared his well-known devotion to abortion. Only after Clinton was elected president would Packwood be cut loose from the protective adjectives of a pro-abortion press. Regurgitating New York Times editorials as his personal philosophy would not save him now. The moment Packwood's abortion rights armor dropped, not only was his reprehensible personal behavior revealed, but everything else about him changed as well. His background, his intelligence, his personality, his looks, the state of his marriage, indeed his whole life story, were suddenly completely different. Once a jut-jawed iconoclast, Packwood soon became a graceless clod. Overnight, he went from being a voracious reader to being clueless. Instead of being an audacious senator with candor, courage, and political common sense, he was a self-absorbed baby. He had no self-awareness, no sense of a world beyond his own little fiefdom, no comprehension of how others might view him. Packwood had finally found out what it was like to be a real Republican. It's not so much fun when the press doesn't like you. Even granting that Packwood's abuse of women cast a different light on him, he was still the same man. But in the press accounts, all the shiny, laudatory details about Packwood's career, family, wife, office, and home were summarily washed down the memory hole. What happened to Packwood is a stunning example of the media's power both to destroy and to protect. It's absurd enough when the media describes Teddy Kennedy as a man of principle and Jesse Helms as a pandering bigot. In the case of Packwood, the media's good dog, bad dog descriptions were applied to the exact same human being. It kind of makes you wonder, was Packwood ever all that canny, shrewd, and courageous, really? There's no intellectual honesty whatsoever in media descriptions of politicians. Journalism is war by other means. The New York Times fumed and huffed about Packwood, snippily demanding that Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole throw Packwood out of the Senate. Quote, "If Mr. Dole has already forgotten why Mr. Packwood was forced to resign, the rest of America has not. Mr. Packwood repeatedly tried to take sexual advantage of women dependent on him for jobs and altered evidence he thought might be very incriminating." A few years later, that same editorial page would be viciously denouncing the House of Representatives for impeaching President Clinton. Compare that to Pat Buchanan, who was one of the first to call on Packwood to resign, saying he had engaged in, quote, "egregious behavior and an abuse of power by a United States senator." By calling on Packwood to resign, Buchanan was parting company from politicians such as Republican Senator Bob Dole. Being a moderate Republican satisfies the beast only as long as they still need you for pro-abortion votes and demeaning quotes about your fellow Republicans. But no matter how much the press seems to idolize this or that moderate Republican, the moment the feisty independent maverick is unnecessary, he will transform overnight into Joey Buttafuoco. The media may have a crush on liberal Republicans, but don't expect them to respect you in the morning. As the Packwood case illustrates, politicians with something to hide, say, wild promiscuity, stupidity, Chappaquiddick, or a former membership in the Ku Klux Klan, had best be liberals. There may be other reasons to be a liberal, generalized hatred of America, for example. But one very good reason is that you need the media's protection. Only politicians with nothing to hide dare risk displeasing the New York Times editorial page. There is no possibility, for example, that Jesse Helms could have remained in the United States Senate if he had killed a girl at Chappaquiddick like Democratic Senator Teddy Kennedy, if he had been a former Ku Klux Klanner like Democratic Senator Robert Byrd, if he had molested staffers like pro-choice liberal Republican Bob Packwood, or if he were a half-wit like pro-choice liberal Republican Jim Jeffords. Any conservative Republican who did any of these things would soon cease being a politician, or would cease being a conservative. Republicans cannot survive disgrace, not even a moderate Republican. But Republicans liked by liberals have something to hide, most often craven stupidity. All Republicans sense deep in their beings that they can stave off the bitter enmity of the media by being liberals, especially by being stalwart defenders of abortion. The media's reward system is extremely effective with half-brights. Most politicians would rather face down the Viet Cong than be ridiculed by Katie Couric. It's one thing to be hung upside down and have bamboo shoots stuck under your fingernails, but for the media to accuse you of being against progress and enlightenment, as the New York Times said of Jesse Helms, or to call you an airhead, as Katie Couric said of Ronald Reagan, well, that makes strong men tremble and weak men liberals. It is baffling, therefore, that Republican activists often praise Republican politicians for being respected by the press. That's supposed to be the selling point. The media seems to like him. There is no surer proof of a Republican mediocrity than the media's respect. Remember, the media liked Jack Kemp once, too. As a rule of thumb, liberals are not the best source of information on the Republicans' strongest candidate. Still, the media insists on straight-facedly reporting that Democrats are scared of running against bird brains like Christy Todd Whitman while claiming to hope Republicans would be foolish enough to nominate a sure loser like Ronald Reagan. Consequently, it is highly instructive to note which Republicans the media dub courageous, a maverick, or flinty. The establishment press's admiring use of the adjective flinty in reference to sellout Northeastern Republicans is as inevitable as the tabloid's use of luscious to describe Hollywood starlets. Flinty Senator Jim Jeffords was showered with fulsome praise when he officially left the Republican Party. Having never in his life voted with the Republican Party on any half-important issue, Jeffords' defection was about as newsworthy as Elton John coming out of the closet. While the media treats President Bush's Yale education like some sort of scam, Jim Jeffords' degree from Yale cannot be cited often enough. And consider that Jeffords got into Yale long before the terrorizing reign of the SATs, back when admission to the Ivy Leagues turned on social class rather than standardized tests. But the vigilant reader will find only the most sublimated references in the establishment press to the blinding fact that Jeffords is a little D-U-M-M. There is no Republican alive who does not instinctively understand the protective coloration that being pro-choice affords. Support for abortion is the last refuge of Republicans who cannot rely on native intelligence or good living to avoid being destroyed by the media. The issue doesn't have to be abortion, of course, though it's hard to think of a position that provides such a bulletproof shield for idiots and lechers. Try to think of a pro-abortion politician, Republican or Democrat, who is dumb. Simply as a matter of statistics, there must be boatloads of them. The fact that none leap to mind shows how well the media's protection racket works. Indeed, there is only one prominent pro-choice Republican who has ever demonstrated that he does have the guts and IQ to stand up to media attacks, Rudolph Giuliani. As mayor of New York, Giuliani refused to yield to the left on a slew of other hot-button issues, aggressively opposing affirmative action administrators, pornographic artists, legal aid lawyers, useless government employees, and other key Democratic constituencies. Another profile in liberal courage is former New Jersey Governor Christy Todd Whitman, appointed by President Bush to run the Environmental Protection Agency. The first giveaway that Whitman is pro-choice is how the media gush over her. Referring to her amazing popularity as a potentially national phenomenon, the New York Times quoted experts saying they could understand why other politicians want to be like Whitman, because it means they want to be liked by the public. The equation is rarely stated with such clarity. The Times declared Whitman the GOP's new idol. It's always so touching when a newspaper that hasn't endorsed a Republican presidential candidate since Eisenhower informs Republicans who their new idol is. Whitman's groundbreaking philosophy was sophisticated, prosperous, moderate, and tolerant. But the thing is, the woman is a dimwit. Are you beginning to see the pattern? While accompanying state troopers on patrol in Camden in 1996, Whitman frisked a young black man for a photo op. Her human prop was a citizen who happened to be a genuine suspect. He had already been subjected to a real frisk, but was forced to endure a second phony pat-down by Whitman while she grinned madly for the cameras as if she were squeezing pumpkins at a state fair. In the ensuing hoopla about Whitman's rank insensitivity, a Republican campaign consultant remarked that Whitman was caught in a political no-man's land without support from the left or the right. When Whitman was asked whether Bush should have an abortion litmus test for the Supreme Court, she boasted that, as governor of New Jersey, she had abjured litmus tests for her judicial nominees. "I'll tell you something," she began auspiciously. "I have now appointed 5 of our 7 Supreme Court justices in New Jersey, and I never ask a one of them what they thought about a woman's right to choose." As she explained, it would have been inappropriate. It also would have been moronic, inasmuch as state judges have absolutely nothing to say about the country's abortion policy. Presumably, she didn't ask judicial nominees about their positions on getting more visitors to the Grand Canyon, either. You really wonder if she knows that Roe v. Wade is a decision by the Supreme Court of the United States, which can neither be repealed nor upheld by state Supreme Courts. In any event, asking Whitman about judicial nominees would be like asking Bill Clinton for marital advice. Governor Whitman single-handedly turned the New Jersey Supreme Court into the most ridiculous court in the nation, easily overtaking the once infamous California Supreme Court and even beating back stiff competition from the Florida Supreme Court. If Whitman had chosen judicial nominees by randomly pointing to names in a telephone book, New Jersey would have been better served. Obviously, the nation cried out for Whitman's expertise in choosing judicial nominees. Like other moderate Republicans, Whitman is at least smart enough to realize she cannot rely on her genetic capacities to avoid being called stupid. Luckily for her, actual intelligence has nothing to do with being called smart by the media. Whitman's avid and outspoken support for abortion assured her status as a Republican idol, idolized exclusively by the media that decide who will and will not be called a Republican idol. This is precisely why abortion makes such an excellent litmus test for Republicans. Not because abortion is the most crucial moral issue facing the country today, or because it is a winning issue electorally, both of which it is, incidentally. The reason it makes such a handy litmus test is that the media detests abortion opponents. Any politician who is pro-life has proved that he needs no camouflage and can get by just fine without the media's phony respect, thank you. The media prattle on about money in politics, corruption, and influence peddling on the basis of flimsy little voter guides distributed by the Christian Coalition. But whatever vast and insidious influence the Christian Coalition voter guides have, they surely couldn't have kept Bob Packwood in office throughout 2 decades of egregious sexual harassment. Only the media can own a politician. The media will tolerate any disreputable behavior in order to win. Principle is nothing to liberals. Winning is everything. Generally, it's difficult to make sweeping statements about the political views of an entire industry, but it's surprisingly easy in the case of the media. In the 1992 presidential election, a mere 43% of Americans voted for Bill Clinton. That same year, 89% of Washington bureau chiefs and reporters voted for Clinton. Only 7% voted for George Bush. It should be noted that, despite their adoration, even Bill Clinton has referred to the media as the knee-jerk liberal press. Indeed, the media elites covering national politics would be indistinguishable from the Democratic Party, except the Democratic Party isn't liberal enough. A higher percentage of the Washington press corps voted for Clinton in 1992 than did this demographic category, registered Democrats. CNN's Peter Arnett said of the survey, "Howard Fineman of Newsweek probably voted for Clinton. I voted for Clinton. But, you know, when it gets to the vote, you do it, and then you go on with your journalism. I don't think the two were really related." Clinton's press secretary, Michael McCurry, feigned shock, saying, "If these guys actually voted for Clinton, why don't they actually be nicer to him in print?" One of the rare voices of sanity was Wolf Blitzer, who said that if the survey was accurate, it would suggest that there is a problem. The wildly disproportionate percentage of liberals in the media is not an insignificant point. The media determine how the news will be served up, how the players are characterized, what news to report, and what news not to report. The same cliches, biases, and outright lies are constantly reinforced through the media sound chamber. One of the blabocracy's favorite lies is that the media is not liberal. They love this one, hauling it out at the slightest provocation, polishing absurd studies proving the media is, if anything, conservative, and running stories on the myth of the liberal media and the so-called liberal press. A study analyzing the New York Times coverage of the 2000 presidential race conclusively proved that this liberal bastion published 50% more anti-Gore articles than anti-Bush, and nearly twice as many pro-Bush articles as pro-Gore. Claims of conservative bias in the media at large are amusing oddities, but a claim that the New York Times has a conservative bias can be explained only by the sheer joy liberals take in telling lies. This is how liberals flaunt their massive control over news in America. The fact that everyone knows they are lying is part of the fun. They take insolent pleasure in saying absurd things, like college radicals giving revolutionary speeches at their parents' dinner table. We will raid their wine cellars and have their women. The New York Times hasn't endorsed a Republican president for half a century. Though the Times generally issues endorsements as if it is the Oracle of Delphi, in 1972 the Times endorsed George McGovern, early and enthusiastically, and he carried one state. When vast majorities of Americans voted for Ronald Reagan and George Bush, the New York Times was endorsing Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, and Michael Dukakis. Even the last winning Democrat the paper endorsed, Bill Clinton, never got as much as half the country to vote for him. Indeed, through its tried-and-true method of mechanically endorsing every Democrat, the Times hasn't endorsed a presidential candidate who got as much as 50% of the vote for over a quarter century. So, maybe the Times is pro-Republican compared to the Berkeley Student Union. But there is no possible calculus under which the Times could be called pro-Republican compared to Americans, arguably a more relevant control group. It is a peevish liberal trope to claim, as liberal pundit Lawrence O'Donnell, former aide to Senator Moynihan, does, to get mail and viewer reaction that says, I'm just one of those awful Republicans, and then I get mail that says, I'm just one of those awful Democrats. I'd like to see one of those letters accusing O'Donnell of being a Republican. I'd file them away with the ones telling Larry Flint he's not filthy enough. NBC News correspondent Joe Johns argued that it's very hard to draw a clear picture about what the media are. For every liberal-leaning newspaper, there's the Washington Times. And for every person who is not struck by lightning, there's one who is. Liberal fairness is they get all major means of news dissemination in America, and conservatives get the Washington Times, the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, and now Fox News Channel. In 1996, a longtime veteran of CBS News, Bernard Goldberg, wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal asserting that the networks and other media elites have a liberal bias. In response to Goldberg's statement of the blindingly obvious, Bob Schieffer, a CBS colleague, responded, "People are just stunned. It's just such a wacky charge. I don't know what Bernie was driving at. It just sounds bizarre." Dan Rather criticized Goldberg for writing his column for a conservative newspaper like the Wall Street Journal. Rather wrote this in a column published in the New York Times, which he hailed as an example of a middle-of-the-road newspaper. Norman Perlstein, editor-in-chief of Time Warner Magazines, responded to Goldberg's bemused citation of Dan Rather referring to the New York Times as middle-of-the-road by earnestly repeating that the New York Times is middle-of-the-road. And not only that, but to call the New York Times left-wing is absurd, Perlstein said. Evidently, to call any publication left-wing is absurd. Not one of them is, not one. Not even newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post that endorsed Walter Mondale for president the year voters in 49 states chose Ronald Reagan. As Perlstein explained, there is no active, aggressive, important publication of the left in America. Either he means left-wing compared to Pravda, or he was accusing the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Detroit Free Press, the Philadelphia Inquirer, among many, many others, of being slothful, passive, and unimportant publications. When Goldberg expanded upon his thesis in his number one best-selling book, Bias, Tom Shales, the Washington Post TV reporter, accused Goldberg of, quote, hauling out the old canard about the media being liberal. In addition, Shales made the point that the Emmy Award-winning Goldberg was a full-time addle-pated windbag, a no-talent hack, laughably inept, not a bright shining star, disheveled and bleary-eyed on the air, and a flop as a network correspondent. If any of that were true, then the real scandal is that CBS News kept the inept windbag on air for 30 years. Shales also noted that Goldberg was a lousy writer. Good writing is apparently this, also from Shales' piece, quote, "And we all know how unbiased those Wall Street Journal editorials are. Gosh, it is so hard to figure out where they're coming from." To obscure the overwhelming liberal dominance of the media, the few designated media conservatives are cited tirelessly in testimonies to the ideological diversity in the nation's newsrooms. Democrats in the media are editors, national correspondents, news anchors, and reporters. Republicans in the media are, from the right, polemicists grudgingly tolerated within the liberal behemoth. Republican views must be accompanied by a conspicuous warning, partisan conservative opinion coming. Neutral news slots are reserved for Democrats exclusively. Balance is created by having a liberal-hosted debate between a liberal Democrat and a moderate Republican. Thus, in a typical formulation, a Gannett newspaper article on the revolving door between politics and the media mentions Tim Russert, NBC's Washington bureau chief and Meet the Press host, and Strobe Talbot, former Time magazine reporter, in the same breath with three Republicans who have each held the novelty conservative seat on CNN's Crossfire, Mary Matlin, John Sununu, and Pat Buchanan. Outside of Fox News, the from-the-right seat on Crossfire is one of the rare paid positions available for conservatives on TV. The distinction between opinion journalism and objective news coverage is seemingly impossible for liberals to grasp. In addition to Buchanan, the media's other approved Republicans include William Safire and George Will. Noticeably, even to win a position as the designated conservative opinion journalist requires an IQ approximately 3 standard deviations above Dan Rather's. Safire, the New York Times House Republican, voted for Clinton in 1992. He endorsed Clinton in a column on the now hilarious grounds that Bush was stonewalling on a potential scandal within his administration. It is thus quite possible that not one writer or editor at the New York Times voted for Bush in 1992, when his opponent got only 43% of the nation's vote. In any event, Buchanan, Safire, and Will's counterparts are not Tim Russert or Strobe Talbot. Their true counterparts are other polemicists, like Bill Press and Juan Williams. What conservatives object to is not liberal opinion commentary, but rather ostensibly objective news coated with smears. At ABC News, conservative means the most conservative member of the Clinton administration. Throughout the 2000 presidential campaign, political commentary was provided by dueling analysts George Stephanopoulos and David Gergen, both of whom worked for Clinton. Gergen has admittedly also worked for Republican administrations. How about Gergen and Buchanan rounding out the left and right? No, that would be unthinkable. But it seems perfectly normal for the political spectrum at ABC to stretch all the way from Clinton staffer to Clinton staffer. Between the two former Clinton administration staffers, only the one who never worked for any Republican administration is the one who landed a permanent position at ABC. But not to worry, ABC's Diane Sawyer grilled Stephanopoulos on his partisanship, saying, "You are so much about passion for politics, and it doesn't matter to you. I mean, I really mean this. You've been completely nonpartisan in covering the news." ABC chose as a legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin, a political hack duly celebrated for making things up, engaging in unethical behavior, and sliming other liberal journalists for a want of alacrity in bending over for Bill Clinton. Sued by his former boss, independent counsel Lawrence Walsh, for violating confidentiality agreements Toobin signed with the office, a Kennedy-appointed federal appeals court judge found he had engaged in, quote, "conduct which manipulates procedure," and harshly denounced Toobin's dubious behavior. After Newsweek reporter Michael Isikoff turned down Toobin's request to co-author a book on Clinton, Toobin wrote his own book, which denounced Isikoff's solo project as, quote, "tawdry voyeurism," without mentioning that he had tried to get in on Isikoff's voyeurism but was rejected. The New York Times book reviewer Michiko Kakutani called Toobin's book highly partisan and willfully subjective, full of dubious assertions, petty meanness, contradictions, and perplexing assertions. The guy who was too partisan for the New York Times and too unethical for Lawrence Walsh was a perfect fit as ABC's legal analyst. Merely for having liberals debate authentic conservatives, authentic meaning did not work for the Clinton administration, Fox News Channel is known as the conservative network. Until a few years ago, when Fox News Channel got Brit Hume, there has been only one host of his own television show who might possibly have voted for Ronald Reagan, John McLaughlin, of his namesake, the McLaughlin Group. Ostentatiously conservative and opinionated, McLaughlin does not purport to be neutral. His show is balanced with two liberals and two conservatives. Fox News personality Bill O'Reilly is denounced as a conservative by people who believe the nation's newsrooms accurately reflect the political spectrum. O'Reilly is anti-death penalty and pro-gun control. He believes in global warming and thought Elian Gonzalez should go back to Cuba, not positions generally associated with the Republican Party. Indeed, O'Reilly's only manifest conservative credential is that he strongly disapproves of hucksters and liars. Further distracting from the massive liberal hegemony of the media, any accidental Republicans who wander Elmer Fudd-like into hard news reporting are endlessly showcased to support the claim that both sides, Republicans as well as Democrats, pass through the revolving door between politics and journalism. But somehow, only a Republican's passage through the revolving door ever provokes frenzies of media introspection and self-criticism. Consequently, small children can recite in their sleep that Diane Sawyer once worked for Richard Nixon. But you have to do research to find out that Brian Williams, Leslie Stahl, Jane Pauley, Jeff Greenfield, Tim Russert, Ken Bode, Bill Moyers, Rick Inderfirth, Pierre Salinger, to name a few TV news personalities, all worked for Democrats. In another generation, no one will remember that George Stephanopoulos got his big break into network news on the staff of a Democratic president. And not just any Democratic president, but one who was impeached, held in contempt by a federal judge, and disbarred by the Supreme Court. Hiring Stephanopoulos would be the equivalent of a major network hiring Chuck Colson immediately after Watergate. Interestingly, though, none of President Nixon's henchmen made the jump to network news. More contemporaneously, Tony Blankley's television career has not been so illustrious or remunerative as Stephanopoulos's. This is despite the fact that Blankley is telegenic, bright, politically astute, and, a bonus, did not work for a felon. Rather, Blankley worked for one of the most consequential politicians in the last century, Newt Gingrich. Clinton's aide is a rising star in television news. Gingrich's will never be an objective political analyst anyplace. Instead, Blankley is relegated to one of television's conservative novelty seats. Even Gingrich himself could only be hired by one network, Fox News. Only Republican politics is deemed partisan. Moving back and forth between left-wing politics and a media career is like moving from the Washington Post to Newsweek. After a heavily criticized tenure as Clinton's press secretary, Dee Dee Myers jumped to lucrative positions on cable news and with Vanity Fair magazine. She was hired at CNBC by Roger Ailes, the man now touted as the evil genius behind Fox News's conservative bias. Vanity Fair created the post exclusively for Myers. She was scheduled to appear on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno soon after leaving the White House, but ended up canceling on account of a drunk driving charge. James Carville has served as guest host on CNN's Larry King Live. It is impossible to imagine CNN choosing a guest host from among Carville's opposites, assuming such exists. Evidently, there is no Republican in the entire universe capable of leaving his subjectivity at the door the way Carville can. When Mark Green lost the New York mayoral election in 2001, the New York Times casually reported that, among his likely next moves, a topic of interest to precisely no one, including Mrs. Green, was his serving as a host on a serious television talk show. A spot on television seemed a logical next step for a Democrat so liberal that even New York City had rejected him. Democrat journalists not only far outnumber their Republican counterparts, but outflank them on the ideological spectrum. A surprising number of establishment journalists worked for far-left liberals whose closest counterpart on the right would be the John Birch Society. Graduate for graduate, the office of Mayor John Lindsay seems to have launched more big-name media stars than the Columbia School of Journalism. Though at the beginning of his political career, Lindsay called himself a Republican, even the New York Times wasn't fooled, describing his reign as a melange of failed liberal experiments, unwieldy government super-agencies, and a mistaken belief that the city could tax itself out of financial troubles. Among the media careers that began on Mayor Lindsay's political staff are Leslie Stahl, CBS, Jeff Greenfield, CNN, Ken Auletta, New Yorker, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Disney and DreamWorks, and Stephen Brill, muckraking liberal journalist at large. As the poll of Washington political reporters suggests, print journalists also represent an ideological span from Democrat to far-left Democrat. Some of the former Democratic staffers who now write the news are the following. David Shipley went straight from the Clinton White House, where he was a speechwriter for both Bill and Hillary, to being a writer and editor at the New York Times, where his wife, who worked for Gore, was fawningly profiled without mention of her husband's job. Ken Auletta, who writes about politics and the media for The New Yorker, embarked on his career in journalism by working for a series of liberal Democrats. Auletta served in the Johnson administration as special assistant to the Undersecretary of Commerce, worked on Senator Robert F. Kennedy's presidential campaign, managed both of Democratic Howard J. Samuel's campaigns for governor of New York, and was the executive director of the New York City Off-Track Betting Corporation under Mayor John Lindsay. A LexisNexis search turns up no documents that mention that Auletta worked for Johnson, Kennedy, or Lindsay. Leslie Gelb was a national security columnist and deputy editorial page editor for the New York Times amid stints on the staffs of Senator Jacob Javits, President Lyndon Johnson, and President Jimmy Carter. James Fallows, who was President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter, has been the Washington editor of the Atlantic Monthly, a writer for the New York Times Magazine, the Industry Standard, the New Yorker, and the American Prospect. Tom Johnson, former publisher of the Los Angeles Times and former CNN chairman and chief executive, was an aide to Lyndon Johnson. Walter Pincus writes about national security for the Washington Post and has been a consultant for both CBS and NBC News. He twice took sabbaticals from journalism, as he put it, to run investigations for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when its chairman was J.W. Fulbright, Democrat of Arkansas. His wife was a political appointee in the Clinton administration. Jack Rosenthal was a Washington correspondent for the New York Times and served for many years as the editorial page editor. Rosenthal served in both the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, including as executive assistant to Undersecretary of State in the Johnson administration. John Siegenthaler was an assistant to Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy and also an assistant to President Kennedy's liaison to Governor George Wallace. He went on to become the editor and publisher of the Nashville Tennessean, editorial director of USA Today, president of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and president of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University. Hailing from a family of Democratic politicians also appears to be an excellent springboard for a career in journalism. Though liberals treated the discovery of a Bush cousin at Fox News like a latter-day Kim Philby scandal, working for the media is fairly common in Democrat families. In the relatives of politicians category of on-air television personalities alone, there are Chris Cuomo, ABC correspondent and son of former Democratic governor of New York, Eleanor Mondale, e-correspondent and daughter of Democratic presidential candidate Walter Mondale, Cokie Roberts, co-host of ABC's This Week, both of whose parents were Democratic congressmen. Her father was Representative Hale Boggs, House Majority Leader, Maria Shriver, NBC correspondent and niece of Teddy Kennedy, Evan Thomas, the Newsweek Washington bureau chief and frequent CNBC guest who, when Bob Kerry was considering a run for president, helped kill the Newsweek story on Kerry killing civilians in Vietnam. He is the grandson of Norman Thomas, a four-time socialist candidate for president. Even being the candidate yourself is a good precursor to a career in journalism, provided you are a Democrat. After fluffing the pillows for John and Robert Kennedy from 1961 to 1968, Pierre Salinger was appointed a United States senator from California when the incumbent died. He was beaten by a conservative Republican the moment Californians were consulted on the matter. Upon losing his appointed Senate seat, Salinger went to work for ABC News. Since Salinger pledged to leave the country if Bush were elected, we may finally be free of him. Running for president in the Democratic primaries was Jesse Jackson's stepping stone to his own show on CNN, unironically titled Both Sides. Jackson's show wasn't even a Mutt and Jeff routine with a conservative analyst to provide balance. Jackson was the sole host. Jackson had already run for president twice and was contemplating a third run when CNN gave him his own show. This would have been like CNN making Patrick Buchanan the sole host of Crossfire between his runs for president, except that Buchanan was a lot more popular with the American electorate than Jackson was. Indeed, Jackson isn't just a Democrat. He's the man who stood on Cuban soil and chanted, "Long live Fidel Castro, long live Che Guevara." An entertainment column in the Los Angeles Times took note of CNN's giving Jackson his own show and praised the network for broadening the ideological spectrum on TV. Jackson, it seems, would be the first openly partisan liberal host of a public affairs talk or interview series. This was important because the range of political opinion in public affairs shows usually ranges from moderate to conservative, almost totally excluding the left. We will raid their wine cellars and have their women. Jackson's son also got his own television show while actually serving in Congress. A CBS-owned television station, WBBM Channel 2, planned to give the Democratic congressman his own talk show, Chicago Focus with Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. There is nothing inherently wrong with partisan public service as a precursor to a career in journalism. It is not manifestly obvious why people without political experience would make superior journalists or be any less objective than New York Times editor Pinch Sulzberger or CBS's Dan Rather, but it would be nice if more than one party were permitted to make the transition through the infamous revolving door. Being a liberal Democrat is simply not considered partisan, certainly nothing meriting comment. Only Republicans within the media club cry out for denunciatory editorials in the New York Times. In the midst of this flowering of ideological diversity in the news business, CBS hired former Congresswoman Susan Molinari in 1997 to co-anchor a new Saturday morning show. Molinari's job was to cover cooking, fitness, and movies. Judging by the media reaction, you could be forgiven for thinking CBS had turned over its entire news division to the Republican National Committee. The New York Times editorialized on this offense to objective news reporting in a huffy piece titled "The GOP News from CBS." At the press conference announcing Molinari's hiring, the first question from the watchdog press was, how can you make Susan Molinari a quote-unquote CBS anchor person when she's put no time in the news business and is an absolute amateur? A CBS executive quickly justified the hiring, promising that Molinari would be limited to analysis, not commentary. Or was it commentary but not analysis? In an example of how professional journalists nail down details like that, in contradistinction to quote-unquote journalists like Molinari, columnist Sandy Grady said Molinari was limited to commentary, not analysis. But the New York Times reported that she was restricted to analysis, but not commentary. In any event, Molinari would be on a tight leash. Anonymous Molinari critics were cited in the New York Times questioning, quote, whether she can be neutral in reporting and interviewing, given her partisan Republican background. Non-anonymous National Public Radio's Nina Totenberg showed how serious journalists work, remarking of Molinari's CBS gig, well, this really makes me want to puke. You know, at least CBS had the decency, when they hired Diane Sawyer from the Nixon White House, to make her go out and stand in the rain for a year or so, to earn her position. It just makes me want to throw up. At the time of Totenberg's hard-hitting analysis, NPR's president was Delano Lewis, who had been chief fundraiser for Washington mayor Marion Barry. He had joined NPR when the former president, Douglas Bennett, a Carter administration refugee, left to join the Clinton administration. Bennett had replaced Frank Mankiewicz, who had worked for George McGovern's 1972 presidential campaign. But the press was seized with anxiety about Molinari's job giving cooking and sewing tips on a morning TV show. As the New York Times put it, there was concern about the potentially awkward transition from being one of the nation's best-known advocates of Republican ideology to becoming a CBS news anchor. More than 100 newspaper articles were published on the threat to honest journalism posed by CBS's hiring of Molinari, moderate pro-abortion Republican Molinari. The most detached editorial title was from the Hartford Courant, "Susan Molinari is not Walter Cronkite." Yes, Walter Cronkite was a pious left-wing blowhard. Molinari may have been a pro-choice, moderate Republican, but at least she was not Walter Cronkite. Media liberals not only personally know no conservatives, but they frequently appear to be completely unaware that conservatives exist. They must still be puzzling over Reagan's landslides. As impish fate would have it, at about the same time CBS hired Molinari, it was also hiring another former member of Congress, Democratic Senator and future presidential candidate Bill Bradley. Bradley was not restricted to decorating tips, but was hired to deliver serious news pieces on the CBS Evening News. There wouldn't have been a peep about CBS hiring Bradley, who also had no experience in journalism, but for the hapless fluke of being so close in time to the Molinari emergency. As it was, Bradley's hiring was mentioned only as a sidebar to articles furiously condemning CBS for hiring Molinari. A LexisNexis search for 1997 turns up 50 news items that mention Molinari in the same sentence as revolving door. Only 12 of those articles include so much as a reference to Bradley. Meanwhile, every single news item that uses the term revolving door in a sentence with Bradley, all 17 of them, also mentions Molinari. Only Republicans interrupting the left's lock on the media are subjected to bitter reproach. Every incident of a Republican sneaking into the news apparatus becomes an instant scandal. It is criminal to be a conservative, and conservatives must be hunted. The most famous alleged Republican in the mainstream media is Diane Milhouse Sawyer. Sawyer's youthful indiscretion of working for Richard Nixon is persistently cited to support the proposition that the revolving door includes both Republicans and Democrats. Let's examine that. In her early 20s, Sawyer got a low-level job in the Nixon White House through her father's connections. Sawyer has explained that she was simply looking for any job in politics and said, "If someone like George McGovern had offered me a job, I'd almost certainly have taken it." Her only involvement in politics prior to becoming an assistant in Nixon's press office was to march in a campus protest against mandatory Bible class at Wellesley College. While working at the White House, Sawyer ran into Nixon precisely once. Indeed, Sawyer's job in Nixon's White House was so ministerial that when a dying rabbi and Nixon confidant claimed she was deep throat, Bob Woodward laughed out loud, noting Sawyer's subsidiary role in the Nixon White House. As with Molinari, Sawyer's hiring at CBS News in 1978 became an instant scandal. CBS big feet Dan Rather and Robert Pierpont were beside themselves with righteous indignation. Pierpont informed a CBS vice president, "I don't like hiring people into news who have been involved in party politics." Rather complained that Sawyer had no credibility and had been discredited by her work for Nixon. Sawyer herself recalls that conversations would stop as I entered the room. She later rectified things by giving Nixon a hostile interview, winning plaudits from the establishment press. In response to some unexceptional remarks Nixon made about female reporters treating first ladies unfairly because, quote, "women reporters think they have to be tougher than men," Sawyer reacted like a wounded tigress and snapped, "How do you know that women of the press are such carnivores?" Newsweek called it Sawyer's finest hour. Diane Sawyer's connection to Richard Nixon, youthful indiscretion though it was, is the stuff of media legend. But there is a virtual blackout on the information that Sawyer's CBS colleague, Leslie Stahl, was, in her 30s as an emancipated adult, a speechwriter for left-wing John Lindsay. In broad LexisNexis searches for news items mentioning John Lindsay and Leslie Stahl, only 8 items turn up. Searches for Diane Sawyer and Richard Nixon retrieved over 700 news items. Unlike Sawyer, Stahl was never required to distance herself from her left-wing political activism, nor does she. When 2/3 of Americans were telling pollsters they didn't believe Anita Hill, Stahl found Hill completely credible, saying, quote, "She brings out what every woman has always known and doesn't even talk about. Like Anita Hill, most women don't stop a guy." Still in all, Diane, "I would have worked for McGovern Sawyer," is a perennial fixture as the Republican in stories on the revolving door between politics and media. And she worked for a Republican only by accident, stumbling into a White House job in a Republican administration 3 decades ago. If we're going to have to keep hearing about the revolving door on the basis of a single news personality, Republicans at least ought to have the option of choosing someone other than Sawyer. Bitterly complaining about a George Bush cousin working behind the camera at Fox News on election night, Salon's Eric Bohler proclaimed that by hiring George Bush's cousin to run a crucial part of its election coverage, the right-wing Fox network hits a new low in conflict of interest. Why didn't the Fox News channel hire George Will to man its election night decision desk? Or Peggy Noonan? Or William Safire? Hell, why not go right to the source and hire George Bush himself? Mainstream publications like the Los Angeles Times were still waving the bloody shirt a month into the Bush presidency. New York University professor Todd Gitlin wrote on the op-ed page that if a Gore cousin had been employed at one of the networks, can anyone reasonably doubt that the pundits would be working themselves into a nonstop lather charging the liberal media as accessories to grand larceny? How about this? Suppose that 6 relatives of Republican politicians were scattered throughout network news, as well as major national publications, along with another 12 veterans of Republican politics, not as opinion journalists, but as objective news and political analysts. Suppose the only slots available to Democrats were liberal commentary positions. From the left, Leslie Stahl. Pat Buchanan and Pat Robertson would be the dueling political commentators on ABC News, which would at least have the virtue of providing a lively debate. George Will would be the host of Meet the Press. Peggy Noonan and Tony Blankley would provide objective political analysis. That is the news media in America, except they're all liberal Democrats. The occasional heretics from the liberal orthodoxy are regularly trotted out for the ritualistic Orwellian 2 minutes hate. The one TV station that is not an ocean of liberal Democrats, punctuated by the occasional from the right opinion commentator, is Fox News Channel. Liberals have responded